And that learning has come after a very long time. Earlier it was ulta. We would look at a video, try and make sense out of it, feel emotional about it, ki, you know, kyun nahi chala, kyun nahi chala, kyun nahi chala. Then have feelings, acha, okay, this is why it didn't work. Shayad ye maine theek se nahi bulwaya hoga, isme angle galat ho gaya hai. But at the end of the day, you have data that speaks volumes, right? So it's just about translating that data into an insight and then adapting it across different platforms. Like, you know, Shobhit was sharing the story once where he was walking down the stairs and there were these kids who were sitting on the stairs playing Ludo King. Now the kids were talking to each other while playing Ludo King. So he realized that there is a social behavior linked to gaming.
Right.
And even if you look at our own app right now, the biggest tool that's used is speaking practice. And in speaking practice, people are actually talking about anything in the world, but they're talking in English.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jibraj, and today I have with me a very special guest. Join me in welcoming Supriya Paul, the co-founder and CEO of Josh Talks, which is one of India's largest distribution platforms, also building, soon to become one of India's leading education platforms. Thank you so much, Supriya, for joining me. Very delighted to be hosting you.
No, thank you so much. I think this is a long time pending. So really excited for this conversation.
Exactly. I've been meaning to host you for a while because for anybody who's in the content space, Josh Talks is a go-to inspiration platform.
Yeah.
And I've heard so much from common friends, mentors in the ecosystem about your journey. And for somebody who's young himself, it, you know, brings a lot of joy and inspiration to know what you've built. As we go through, you know, the next couple of minutes, through the conversation, what I really want to crack is how to build a distribution first business and also understand all the things you've done along the way, which have been very natural yet feel like a insanely compounding curve. So where I want to start, though, although interestingly, is take us back to, you know, your 19-year-old self who decided to, in a very unconventional setting, start Josh Talks. I know you've mentioned this story before in your own words, but I'd love to know what was that, you know, the courage that it took at the time, because this was unconventional as a business. There was no real, I mean, direct money-making objective, right? So how did you convince your parents? You've spoken about this. Maybe take us back to that time. It'll be a great starting point.
Yeah, so I think when I was 19 years old, I wasn't the person that I am today. I was extremely unsure and underconfident about, you know, where I wanted my life to be. I was one of those kids who had studied extremely hard to be a topper, but knew nothing beyond being a topper. So, you know, life's objective was you get the right kind of marks, you get the right kind of college. From college, you get the right kind of placement, you grow ranks, you become partner at one of the big fours. And that's sort of the journey or trajectory that I was on. Until I realized that it wasn't something that actually made me happy. You know, being someone who was sort of forced to be on a desk. And I learned this through a bunch of internships also that I did, made me realize that that wasn't my DNA. But interestingly enough, no one else had told me otherwise. Everyone had sort of seen the traits that I had when I was a child. Like I remember, and it's very funny, Punjabi families mein bahut hota hai, so you'll relate to this. But whenever there were guests who were coming home, I was the one who would not go up and say hi. So, you know, my parents and everyone around me took it as ki I'm non-confrontational. I don't like talking to people. I'm shy. I'm timid. So maybe I will not do well in a role where I have to actually go and talk to people. So that was kind of fed into my mind from the very beginning that, you know, you are an introvert and introverts succeed in a certain kind of role. And that's the role that you should be chasing. But a lot of things changed in college. I think I got exposed to a very different world and I realized that I'm not the only one who's lost. I also met Shobhit at this time and Shobhit is my co-founder and he came from a radically different background. Like he left school to pursue sports full-time. He was cycling for the Indian team. He had like more confidence than I have ever seen in any individual. And for me, it just felt so weird that, you know, like, here's the two of us coming from very different backgrounds, but both of us are trying to figure out that, you know, like we kind of had this common frustration that young people have so much potential. We as individuals have so much potential. What if we were able to give direction to that potential? Would that change the outcome of someone's life? And we still came from privilege. So we had exposure, we had our parents, we had teachers, we had the internet over due course of time, we had internships. But people who come from smaller towns and cities in India who don't have that elder brother or their father or their mentor, like you just said, you know, ecosystem, who don't have that mahal, is there a way that we can create a platform that can give direction to their potential? And that's sort of been like the beginning or the spark of Josh. And no other word could justify it or the feeling that we wanted to create other than Josh. So that's Absolutely. How we started.
And that's incredible to hear, and it's amazing how far you've come. What's very interesting is that the vision remains the same to date. However, it's taken multiple different form factors, right? What I'd be curious to know is, what day one pe direction kya thi, right? Like, what was the first point that you wanted to start off with? And where along the way did you start building more and more conviction that, okay, this is working, we'll continue doing this, but we can do this also. And that was, you know, the natural progression.
Yeah. So I think, you know, an interesting way to look at this is that whenever someone from, say, a startup media reports something, right, they'll call whatever we've done as pivots. But for us, it's interestingly not pivots. They've just been an extension of what the larger goal always was, right? When we started, we knew that we are trying to change an outcome for an individual who has no exposure in their life. So our goal was that we kind of have to change the first 20 years of their life. Who they get the right kind of advice from, what courses do they take up, what skill sets do they acquire, what internships do they do, what coaching do they go to. We have to step by step change every single thing. And also what inspires them, what motivates them to actually get up and do something every single day. And so our journey has been a natural extension of us trying to replicate that behavior. So the first thing that we saw was missing was this inherent motivation. Okay, so agar aap kisi se bhi baat karo na, who jo ek chote shehar ya gaon se aate hain, they live their life in debt. So it's generational debt that keeps getting passed on and on and on. And people don't come out of that fear of that background of debt. So the first goal was, can we shake people up? Can we show them that there are many others like you? There are thousands like you who, with the same problems, have still been able to go out and achieve something big in their life. And that's why Josh Talks plays that role, where we have a platform where, you know, absolute grassroots change makers and speakers come, they share their story, and they just talk to people in a very authentic manner and tell them, here is how I did it, and this is what you can do if you want my trajectory in life. And that sparks that first desire to actually get up and do something. And that was the first problem that we wanted to solve, which was inherent motivation. The second problem that we saw was, and actually is not even a skill, but was a big cause of underconfidence in the entire user base that we catered to, which was the inability to speak in English. The inability to listen to this conversation online or to even sit here and watch this because of a deep sense of insecurity and inferiority that comes with it. So we then set out on a, you know, sort of journey to solve for fluently being able to speak in English and launched our app there. And ab kya hai ki there are still so many gaps in education, right? And then that brings with it so many more opportunities and problems for us to solve. So step by step, we're taking, you know, we're moving along that journey and are kind of chasing those goals. But what lies at the core of everything that we've built so far, which is why this has been a really long and patient journey, is the trust that we've built. The brand echoes trust, and that's only happened because for 9 years, we were very consistent with our content. You would never miss a Josh Talk release. And that kind of has given people the sense of satisfaction that if anything comes from Josh, it comes with a guarantee of trust.
Awesome. I think so commendable to know the story, because it just shows the progression and the belief in making things happen and how far you've come. But why don't we take a step forward, and before going more intricate, there are three things that in my opinion are very fundamental to what you've built. One is distribution, the other is very strong narrative, storytelling, and the third is a very intricate understanding of Bharat, as we call it, right? Let's tackle maybe each of these at once, right? Tell us what you've learned about distribution and building a distribution-led business, and how does that maybe help potential founders?
Got it. So I think the only thing that it takes to build a distribution-led business is consistency. Okay. And that's very interesting because, you know, as this whole theory of building a distribution-led business has started becoming very popular now. And people have, like, the entire world is changing to content creation, right? So we see all founders becoming content creators. We see all platforms adopting a way to build distribution online. But very little people actually have patience to follow through with it. Mm-hmm. So even if you look at a platform like YouTube, right? YouTube takes at least 35 to 40 pieces of content for it to start showing any form of results or traction. And then slowly and gradually, it's the power of compounding that kind of kicks in. But for that first 30 or 35 or 40 odd videos that you have to produce, it takes a lot. It takes your entire life off of you. So it's almost running a parallel business, and you have to do it with the same intensity that you would do anything else. People think of distribution or, you know, building organic distribution as one more channel of marketing. It's not like that. The effort that it will take you to be able to master something like performance marketing or ads is very, very different from the effort that it will take for you to build an organic distribution channel. Right. And I think that's very important for people to differentiate and then give it the respect that it deserves and the time that it actually deserves. But for us, it's just been consistently producing content, being very receptive to what the audiences are asking for. What is it that they are searching for? How is our community interacting with us? Like, you know, this is something that we openly share, that everything that we need to know is in the comment section of a YouTube video, right? Yeah. Like every single recommendation and what our audience is saying, that Pulse of Bharat that you talk about as well, wo sab kuch comments ke section mein hi hai. Right. So if you just listen in there, you'll know what else to create next. And from there, we've been able to build multiple different categories.
Yeah.
Whether it was expanding into different regional languages to be able to tap into different pools of audiences, or to even start segmented channels focused on, say, women, which is Josh Talks Asha. We have a financial literacy channel called Josh Talks Money. We have career-focused channels now in UPSC, NEET, JEE. Everything came from what a user was looking for and a comment that they made on one particular video or successive comments that kept coming in. So I think the key things, if I have to summarize for distribution, are one, consistency, and just listening to your audience and building for the audience, not having a high head around this is what I want to say. Sometimes what happens is you do this great brand exercise as a founder and you have an agency who will come and tell you, hey, these are your four pillars. Thought leadership has to work in this way. This is the kind of content that you need to create. But the world doesn't work in that way. You need to create content based on what your audience is willing to accept you for and pay attention to. And that's where I think most organizations and companies also lose out, because they have this idea of their brand in their head, which is not getting translated to the audience in the way that they would like to, you know, listen to it or engage with it. And then there are differences which get formed. So you're not able to stay consistent to that expectation.
Yeah. Oh, very important. I think very, very crucial learnings. What's also fascinating, and you touched upon, right, double clicking here, is that you've been able to repeatedly, you know, get this process right with the vernacular channels, with everything else. Do you think it's about getting that one success and then repeating that accordingly? Or have you had to do different things for different channels? What is the learning when you're iterating with different things?
So from a content point of view, we do have to modify everything to different channels, because India, with its different languages, is like, each language is a unique country, right?
Yeah.
So you have to understand the nuances of what work on ground there. And what are the aspirations of people belonging to different regions? You will not have a standard one-size-fits-all approach for content anywhere. It changes with the audience. But what we've learned, or what we track, you know, day in and day out, are the metrics that control the platform.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is science-based. So even if it's YouTube, and YouTube is our primary medium of distribution, before we look at the content piece and start looking at what the speaker has said, we look at the data. So we look at the sheets which have our CTR. We look at average view duration, which is the time that a user has spent on watching that video. We look at retention graphs to see where the drop-offs have been. After studying that data, we then correlate it with the content that has actually been spoken in the video, and then see where to improve. And that learning has come after a very long time. Earlier, it was ulta. We would look at a video, try and make sense out of it, feel emotional about it, ki, you know, kyun nahi chala, kyun nahi chala, kyun nahi chala. Then have feelings, acha, okay, this is why it didn't work. Shayad ye maine theek se nahi bulwaya hoga, isme angle galat ho gaya hai. But at the end of the day, you have data that speaks volumes, right? So it's just about translating that data into an insight and then adapting it across different platforms.
Got it. So consistency is the key, and then science-based metric approach is what I'll take away from that. Coming to the second factor, right? Storytelling, building very strong narratives. I think anybody, it would be very hard to dispute that there is a better platform than Josh Talks in the country to build strong narratives. What are your learnings in storytelling that you think you can, you know, pass on? What are 3-5 things that you can summarize for us?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is authenticity. if you are saying something to someone or if you're talking on a platform or on a stage, be authentic to who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try and live up with an image that you've created that will do well online.
Mm-hmm.
And that, once the audience is able to catch on to that, right, that this is not who you are as a person and you're trying to be someone else, you lose out as a public speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And there your story goes. So the first is authenticity. The second is relevance, that you have to understand who are you speaking to.
Mm-hmm.
It changes from platform to platform. So who are you speaking to on YouTube? What language are you using will also determine that. Who are you speaking to on Spotify, on audio? And then tweak your content according to that. So always keep the user at the center of whatever you have to say. And then, of course, there are some guiding principles of storytelling, right? That we have these theories around, you know, arches that get created while you're sharing a story. So you should have some medium of conflict, which is where you talk about a challenge or a struggle that came up. And then, of course, have a very strong opening, have a very strong closing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't leave a person watching without an actionable insight. So sometimes we just go on and on and on, but we're not able to break our story into here is a takeaway that you need to have. And for us as an organization, I think one thing that we've really focused on is that our brand has to be very, very strong along with the speaker's story. So Josh has to become an aspirational platform. And I think the beauty of the word is such that every speaker who comes almost always uses it in their talk, right? As a result of which that bond between the user, who's our viewer, and the platform also becomes stronger because they're just listening to the same word again and again and again, and are being able to relate it with their role models.
Yeah.
So it becomes a three-person relationship. It's no longer just the speaker and the viewer. It's the speaker who's come to you because of Josh and you are a viewer. So you respect all three parts of that relationship.
Awesome, awesome. Love that. I think that very intricately breaks down the entire storytelling piece. On the third part, right, like how does Bharat consume content? What are they talking about? What do they want? What are your learnings on that front?
Yeah, I also feel like I have a very, very different view here.
Sure.
Because I feel like, you know, we've made Bharat out to be aliens. That,
true.
Okay, like here is India One who's sitting in an air-conditioned room having this conversation. And here is 99% of India who we've qualified as Bharat, who are doing something which is completely opposite from what we are doing. And let's break them down.
Fair.
But that's not true.
Okay.
Consumption patterns are the same. Time spent on apps is similar. The type of apps may change. So, for example, a lot of people have this misconception or there is a myth that only short video will work because TikTok worked. But that's not true. Our entire viewership comes from long-form pieces of content, right? The average view duration that we have is like 5.5 to 6 minutes. This is all coming from tier 2, tier 3, tier 4 India. So people are watching knowledge content. People are not just looking for masala or entertainment in this audience segment. They are watching high-quality podcasts. They are listening to conversations like this. And everyone is looking to grow. What is sort of different is that we have to spoon feed a little bit of information more than we need to do for audiences like us.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have to break down complex, concepts into maybe a series of multiple videos and introduce new concepts slowly over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from that, I think the taste in music, the taste in content consumption, how people are now going onto platforms like OTTs, everything is changing and it's changing so fast in the overall tier 2, tier 3 segment. But I think one thing that stays consistent and true is that the first preference of content consumption there is either Hindi or their regional language. Unlike us, where we would probably say Hindi or English, but would not go to our, you know, language spoken at home or our mother tongues. So that's the only difference, that the desire to learn also is in a regional language.
Got it.
Even if it is information or a conversation which is intellectually sparring, I would rather hear it in Marathi than hear it in Hindi or English.
Got it. Okay. So I'm going to be vigilant about not thinking of them as two different worlds.
Yeah.
And I love that it's not as different as we would imagine. And we don't have to create that segregation per se. But I really love the intricateness of, you know, ki dheere dheere unko samjhana hoga, right? You have to take, you can't just shock them, I guess.
Yeah.
That's
and
my
it's changed
takeaway.
Because all of the internet now is Bharat. That time is gone, right? Where
the
internet was urban audiences and everyone else was just coming online slowly. It happened in COVID, but it happened so rapidly that now if you even go onto YouTube, a majority of your recommendation and how your feed looks, the type of content that is doing well, is content which is very, very massy. It's no right. longer niche, right? And that's because overall internet consumption and patterns have changed. Right. If you look at even from a gender lens, the number of women who've come online. Yeah. We started our women's channel about 1.5-2 years ago. We were at a point where we were like, will this sustain? Because it's not getting views. What do? We're not making any kind of money. We're losing money every single month on running this channel. And it's now one of our fastest growing channels. It beats even money, which, you know, was doing so well during the stock market phase.
Yeah.
So it's very, very interesting because I think every 2 to 3 years, there is some revolution in the internet. And this has sort of been that era of the Bharat takeover. Yeah. So everything on the internet has changed now.
Awesome. I love that. I think very, very interesting to know these insights and, you know, get that Bharat is now online.
Yeah.
And it's not a different world than India. It is what is India in itself, right? Great. I think we covered this piece. Let's get to maybe, you know, the business side of things. Mm. What we as consumers and users of Josh Talks will see are the videos, which yeah. are great. However, there's so much happening on the back end, right? Talk to us about what does it mean to get this online? How do you, you know, what is the back end operations that is required to get on board? And what is the business model, right?
Sure.
Right? Like a lot of people will wonder after all that beyond the distribution, where is the money, right? So
yeah.
talk to us about that piece.
Yeah. So I'll talk you through the like how everything works first and
sure.
then just kind of combine it with revenue on that side. So for the Josh Talks business, it's a team of 110 people who work across 9 different languages and then an additional 6 to 7 different categories. We run a cumulative of 21 channels now. It's hard to keep up with the number of channels and about 20 million subscribers. So this team has people from various diverse backgrounds covering content, research, storytelling, of course, and then distribution, which is posting the videos online, as well as production and post-production. So from the time that a speaker is chosen or we get a lead of a story, we speak to the person, we try and understand the story, break it down, see relevance to our platform and decide which language or which channel do we want to host that story on. We then begin the process of scripting or structuring, which is about a 20 to 40 day timeline, depending on what speaker and what stage they're at, where we work with them to figure out what should their talk be. Then we have an on-day process where we do a little bit of speech coaching with, you know, body language, gesture control, etc. And then they come and record their talk, which then goes up online. So it is a 4 to 5 stage process. And then even after that, we have content edits and then we decide
right.
which part of the talk we want to take and then we release it. So it seems like machinery when it goes mm-hmm. up, but
yeah.
It takes a lot of human effort and time and creativity to put it through,
That's
especially
true.
Because we are at a scale where we do 300 videos every single month.
Wow.
And 300 long form videos.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a lot to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And that is our distribution powerhouse, right?
Okay.
We get 180 million views on our content online today from across the country. And some of these views are monetized through traditional mediums like AdSense, which
mm-hmm.
is what YouTube gives us, or through social media, Facebook, Snapchat, etc. Some of it is paid for by our long-standing partners.
Okay.
So, for example, if an organization like Amazon wants to advance stories of small and medium businesses in India,
mm-hmm.
they may come in to just support a series of small and medium businesses. If an FMCG brand or a personal care brand wants to talk about Women of Steel or, you know, someone who's a girl who's done something out of the ordinary, they may come and just support some of our women-oriented content. So that's traditionally how the media business works for us. Now, what we also have is that we have distribution channels in different segments. So one of our distribution channels is Josh Talk Spoken English, where we have stories that are covered of people who, you know, kind of got rid of their underconfidence to speak in English, learn the language, and it helped them in their life.
Right.
When you're watching this piece of content online, you will get an ad or a video in between the video telling you about our Josh Talk Spoken English app.
Right.
Once you know of that, you'll then download the app and then you'll pay 500 rupees and then you'll start learning with us. And that becomes the second source of our monetization. And what we are also doing now is that finding out that, hey, where are all our distribution overlaps?
Right.
English is of course a huge problem. It's a problem for the entire country, but it'll take some time to grow because we're charging only 500 rupees. But there are other viewership overlaps, like 30-35% of our users are government job aspirants.
Right.
So we are finding gaps in other markets also to see where is it that we can add some value as Josh, and help them as well. And that's when we'll essentially productize it and capture a part of that value. So the goal is that keep building alternate channels of distribution, build them in career, education, or anything that pushes the human race forward, and then have products that solve a gap in it. And that's sort of how we run it.
Oh, that's amazing to hear. I think that's the first time I've gotten an entire overview of the background process to make stuff happen on the screen. But on the latter end, right, let's continue that thread. So you're now going from, let's say, a content platform to, let's say, an education platform, and from distribution to products, right? How has that personally, helped you or challenged you as an entrepreneur? And what has that meant for the team, right? Do you need a radically different skill vis-a-vis, you know, to build these two platforms? How does that work?
Yeah, so yes, you do need a radically different DNA, I think. To build it, and which is why what we did take as a call was that when we decided to build a product, we moved to Bangalore for 2 years, just because of the mindset and the focus that it needed and the kind of DNA that it needed in the engineering team. They've all moved back now here in the office. I'll make you meet them. But that entire journey of, you know, so Josh Talks has become an organization which is now stable, right? So the media business is stable. There are different teams. Everyone is working. But for skills, we needed something where it was a startup again. Mm-hmm. We needed that DNA of problem solving, trying to figure out every single step all over again, which is why we took that decision to move and make a completely different team. Another thing that kind of helped us along the way is that Shobhit, who's my co-founder, he actually leads product. Along with Harsh and our team, they lived the life of our user. And I don't think many people actually end up doing that. And in the peak of winter in Delhi, the two of them stayed in Chakarpur with our sweet delivery executives. Wo alag baat hai ki andar they had heaters and everyone was coming in to check out their rooms. But by the end of it, they had spent so much time with our users that they knew the pulse. Like, you know, Shobhit was sharing the story once where he was walking down the stairs and there were these kids who were sitting on the stairs playing Ludo King. Now the kids were talking to each other while playing Ludo King. So he realized that there is a social behavior linked to gaming. And even if you look at our own app right now, the biggest tool that's used is speaking practice. And in speaking practice, people are actually talking about anything in the world, but they are talking in English. So we try to absorb, you know, what are sort of fundamental principles or human traits, and what our users are experiencing on ground, how they're behaving on ground, and then took that insight into build it into a feature. But I think our obsession with our users really helped us because we didn't come with that DNA. We also didn't come with that tech background. None of us are from a tech background. Interestingly, Harsh, who leads tech, is actually not an engineer himself. He's self-taught. So what's very, very interesting about all of us in the core team is that we are just problem solvers. And we, none of us are qualified in anything. Like, you know, I love that when we go to investor meetings, people kind of are like, oh, what's your background? And I'm just like, I've just done an undergraduate degree. And they're like, oh, but when did you do a master's in media? I said, no, I didn't do that. Then they'll ask, okay, but you know, who's the engineer in the team? And there is none. We've all learned on YouTube, just like the whole world is learning on YouTube, right? So I think that obviously is like one of our key traits, that once we get obsessed with a problem, we solve for it. And that DNA really works while building a product. So it helped us along the way.
Awesome. Awesome. I love that. I think multiple crucial pointers there, right? Just sticking along for a long time. I think Shobhit had a reel also which went viral about this Ludo, right? And which was great. I've seen some stories where he's been on ground. And I think currently also he's traveling and meeting with UPSC toppers, etc. So this is incredible. What I'd love to understand is, for a viewer and for somebody who's young and curious, I think that this has been like an 8-9 year journey already, right? How do you persevere through these times and keep still looking out for that next big thing? Because many would say that it's easy to get complacent through the journey and be like, "Acha, we'll continue growing maybe on YouTube, have more channels, etc." Right? And that pathway is completely fine as well, for all you know, right? Because that is growing. But how do you still stay curious, up for the next challenge, want to like perfect it? What is that thread like?
Yeah, so I think one is that, you know, we surround ourselves with people who have a similar thought process. And I think if you look at the core team of Josh right now, we all have a similar kind of DNA, which is that no problem is hard enough that we won't be able to solve it. And everyone has done so many different roles in the organization. Dave, who leads content and now is also looking at our government, you know, test prep vertical, started out as someone who was a research associate in the team. So we've all grown from knowing nothing to leading something which is completely out of our area of work. So I think just having a really strong core team helps you stay focused and also helps you kind of realize that you will be able to do this. This is a journey that you will be able to see through. Oftentimes when you're alone and you're building in an isolated sort of framework, you don't get that. And then you try and give up, you try and look for quick ways of making money, how do you scale faster, and then you take decisions that you wouldn't always do. The second thing which has been there, which has been super consistent in our journey, is that we have a very, very strong impact ethos. There have been many opportunities for us to monetize quickly. There have been many opportunities, especially in COVID, to sell. But for us, it's always been that even if we have to sell, but who are we selling to and what will be the resultant of that sale matters a lot, right?
Right.
And that kind of concept always then steers us away and makes us realize that we are interested in building for the long run. We've always wanted to build a company that outlives us. When organizations talk about startups, we talk about Tata. We read those kind of books because for us, it's our brand that we are growing and we want that brand to be a legacy. And then we try and follow suit to their journey, right? They didn't build something in 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 10 years. They have product launches every 5 years. Their innovation works in a time where it's tested through and through before it goes out to market. But then their adoption is really quick because of the loyalty that they have. So we're trying to sort of follow a similar style of working and ethos where we are innovating, but we are emulating organizations that are legacy organizations. And we have that so deep-rooted in our conscience that it steers us away from, you know, short-term wins and helps us stay put to the longer cause.
Incredible. I think all of those learnings, I think that, you know, long-term mindset, mission orientation is what we hear all of the successful Amazon, Google founders say. And it's so nice to hear from you after being at it for this long. And I think the mission orientation really shows. I'd be curious to know this sense of maturity, company building, was it there from day one? Or how much of this is something that you have acquired along the way? And what are some things that maybe, you know, didn't go as planned and that is where, you know, you had somebody else pitch in with the maturity that got you to this mental state?
So I think, so one, it's okay for you to not always be in this mental state and have, you know, a contention within your own brain and keep thinking of the positives or the negatives and try and move here and there and then come back to a mental state that you want for the long run. And that keeps happening in different cycles. But I think some of the things that I learned along the way, which, you know, are things that others could replicate, is that one, don't get distracted by the noise. I am someone who gets very deeply affected by what's happening around me and the people around me. So, you know, there was this wave of if you're not raising capital, you're a loser. If you're not, you know, being able to give an exit to your investors immediately, you're a loser. So there's so many, like, there are waves, right? And in those waves, people were not talking about fundamentals of business. They were not talking about profitability. They were not talking about revenue, which was something which was very strong for us. But they were only talking about capital infusion. And at that time, we did feel astray. I personally felt that, okay, maybe that is the track that we should move on, where we are aggressively raising capital. But then after a period of time and, you know, after actually making a list of pros and cons, we realized that we don't need that. You know, we do need capital, we need sufficient capital and we have brought on investors for it, but we don't need to be on that cycle of just raising again and again because that's not the business that we've built till now. So I think the biggest learning has been that you cut out all the noise and choose your role models very carefully. In this age where everyone is present on social media, they are portraying a story of them which is the brand that they want to build. Sometimes those brands are extremely authentic. Sometimes it's not a real story. But you take these social media icons and then you make them their, you know, your life, and you try and follow them end to end. But things don't work out for you. Like, everything doesn't like become equal in your own journey, right? So I think that's the second thing that I learned, is that be very careful of who your role models are and whose journey you are trying to emulate. And I think between the two of them, if you're able to do that, be on track, you'll be on track.
Awesome. I think that's very fundamental to anything that we do, right? As humans, I think we need to be very internally driven and really like cut down. Like, if we are trying to emulate somebody, it has to be the right people. Awesome. This is, again, very, very interesting. What I'd love to know is, you know, the other part about this is this self-growth, right? I can look at Josh Talks and be like, okay, 20 million subscribers, etc. But I'm sure you have grown massively in the last 9-10 years. If you had to tangibly maybe tell us where your growth has been highest, I think that'll be very interesting, because there are no other ways to quantify founder growth. Unfortunately, company growth gets quantified very easily, yet founder growth does not. So would love to know that.
Yeah, I think the biggest growth or the learning curve has been on the decision, on decision making, right? The decisions that I take today and how I approach them versus the decisions that I probably took 5 years back, 6 years back, and how I approach them back then. So I think that has been something that's, you know, fundamentally changed a lot. You know, like earlier it was rapid, like move fast and break things. Now we're in a phase where it's always about, you know, breaking things down, see the long-term value associated with it, actually analyze the risks associated with the decision, and then take something which can be built to scale. The second thing that I've learned, which has been incredible as a founder, is the value of having everything documented. And I think a large part of the phase that we are in as an organization with our team is also to document every single process and create something which is absolutely replicable. So that's the second thing. And the third thing has been that, you know, I'm just going back to what I said earlier also, that if you feel passionately about a problem and you are willing to stay true to it, then you have to cut the noise. And not let the noise influence you. Because I feel like one of the worst things that I did in my own journey was let that noise influence me and probably take one or two decisions that led us astray for a while. So just staying true to your personal values, your personal beliefs, what the values of the organization are, the mission is, and then ensuring that you keep your head down and you keep working at it. And maybe, now that I said this, maybe the last thing would be that not everything has to be spoken of in public.
Right.
You know, there is a lot of merit in building quietly and slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you put yourself out there so much, you have the world watching you. Right. And then that develops this sense of insecurity that you start feeling on, you know, on screwing up or making any form of mistakes. And then you're just trying to keep up with this impression that you've created for the world. You have to be perfect in every sense. You can't make wrong moves. And it becomes difficult for the individual who's the founder. Yeah. So I think just like keep your head down and like build is something I've learned along the way.
Amazing, amazing. This is very interesting, especially on the last part, right? I was going to bring it up maybe towards the end.
Yeah.
But one of the most fascinating things leading up to this conversation was how honest and upfront you've been about challenges, vulnerability, self-doubt, and you've been, you know, vocal about these things in public forums as well. That doesn't come very easily. So the two-part thing that I'd love to know from you is, A, how do you develop a mindset where in public, and I'm sure in private you're more vocal about this, that you can talk about challenges very easily? Does it come from a safe space of maybe some sense of success, some sense of accomplishment? And two, when you're in this space, right, like a lot of people are unable to address it in the most positive manner or just to like tackle it to begin with.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best way to deal with just things around self-doubt, vulnerability? Because the founder journey or any other journey is not as simplified, linear to begin with, right? How do you navigate that piece?
Yeah, so I think this phase where I've started being more vocal about this has been in the last couple of years. I have had a very intense phase where I've always tried to, you know, project only the good things about my personal life or my work life whenever it's been in public or in conversation. And it's tough to keep up with that because that's not the real you, right? You are going through so many things on a daily basis. You are feeling so many emotions. You have your own problems that are happening at home. You have health issues to deal with. You can't always show up in a form that you expect the world to see because everyone else is also going through that. And I think that's where, you know, if you go back to what we were talking about, storytelling, right? Why do you connect with someone? You connect with someone on a human level because of relevance and relatability. So how are we able to have this conversation? Because we are vulnerable in this conversation, right? If I had to have a perfect image and structured answers, this conversation would not work. And that is something that I've learned over a period of time, that I have nothing to lose by being honest. The only thing that will happen is I might get trolled. Or I might get some judgment from others. But for people who are watching content, whether it's with me or anyone else at Joshan, we're talking, if there's something about our real life that we can put out, which can, you know, maybe get someone else to share something which is deeply personal or vulnerable, it does have a huge effect
positive
on others.
Impact,
right? Like, I've also just started hosting conversations online, and it's literally like we talk about anything on that show. And it's, of course, for women, and just we just have women speakers who are leaders in different fields talking. But we've, like, I just spoke to Swati about her kidney transplant and her mom giving her her kidney. And I asked her, has it made your bond as a mother and daughter closer? Now, people are going to explain the health process of how that actually happened, right? But I genuinely wanted to know, how is that relationship now? And she spoke of it, which is super cool. And so I think these are like some aspects that if you show your real you, people end up relating to you more. And it's easier for you to keep up then. It's easier for you to show up at events. It's easier for you to talk. Otherwise, then you just keep on hiding and, you know, displaying the second personality. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, that helps, I think. The merit in just being yourself is maybe way higher in the longer run than putting up a face and not being comfortable with who you are in public or private. At least that's what I'm taking back. But what's interesting, and as we conclude, right, one last thing on the business front, I think I heard, you know, this investor piece has been there have been ups and downs. There were investors who were interested that you refused to take money from. There was a time there were investors who were not interested. And now you've taken an institutional capital for Josh as well. How do you navigate that piece, right? And when you're building a business which is not as conventional, right? There are no guidelines. This is the first of its kind in the country. So you don't have a benchmark to fall upon. What was that journey like? How did you navigate that piece?
Yeah, I think we were able to get on the right kind of investment at the right time and say no to money which wouldn't have, been extremely beneficial for us also at the right time. And that's because of the impact focus that we have, right? So if you are to take traditional financial investors who are looking at, of course, a return in a certain period of time, and not to say that impact investors are not, but then the orientation changes very quickly. Who your users are, how much you're charging them, those are questions that you have to change or modify according to the kind of capital that you take in. So we've been a little careful about who's on our board and who are the investors that we are working with. And it's been great because we've raised from MDIF, which is a media-based fund in New York. We recently raised from Michael and Susan Dell Foundation and also from Ankur Capital. So the ethos of our board is impact. Of course, there is profitability at the center of it, and everyone wants to make money in this journey, just like we do. But we are all dedicated to the users that we are trying to target. So there is no misalignment on change the user. There is no misalignment on actually helping the user or, you know, doing good by them, having ethics at the front line of business operations. So I think that's really helped us, because for a lot of founders who I also speak to, I see that there is a business journey and then there is an investor journey, and they are working in isolation, where, you know, a lot of things that you are doing at a business level are decisions that you want to take, but then you're also doing 100 things just for investors. And again, like the public-private image that I was talking about, it's very difficult to keep up with that. Because the lines do get blurred. You do have to sit on the same table every single quarter and take decisions on strategic direction for the company. So you can't have two opposing views and two parallel tracks running. You will just burn out and tie yourself. So I think that's why choosing the right investor is incredibly important.
Absolutely. Yeah. I second that for sure. And in my brief learnings with founders, I think everybody, you know, has spoken and iterated on how you need to decide who your investors are, because it's a very, very long-term thing, as we all understand. Awesome. The final thing actually on company building, and maybe on a more strategic tactical level, if you can, Supriya, talk to us about this team construction, right? You talk about problem solving, but this is also a very abstract thing to test for, right?
Yeah.
Very difficult to, let's say, on the first instance or in a couple of interactions, mention who these problem solvers can be, how they'll contribute to the team. And after a point, you're looking for specialized skills as well.
Yeah.
So how has your thought on team building evolved? What are the kind of people that you best attract, or you as an organization are best known to hire, and why does that work for you?
Sure. So I think we are not the right fit right now for people who come from pedigreed institutions who have already a constructed style of working and have a management DNA associated with working. For us, what's worked are people who are gritty and who have a long-term view on things, who want to learn, who are just curious, whether it's, and curiosity is very difficult to test. You know, sometimes it can be in conversation, asking questions and all, but even how much content do you consume?
Right.
What type of content do you view online? All of those things give you an idea about curiosity. And of course, tenacity is something that's extremely important for us, right? When will you give up? How hard will you go till you give up? And for us, that matters above everything. Skills are something we weren't also born with. We didn't study for. We acquired along the journey. So our expectation is not that anyone who joins should already have that. We are running a tech company now with an individual who's leading tech, not being an engineer. I think nothing else is more unconventional than that.
Yeah.
And if he can control, you know, SD3s and 4s and manage their working styles and have senior people report into him and still hold that respect, it's just because of the learning that he acquires while he's on his role, on his job. So I think, you know, for us, it's about the passion that you carry towards the mission, and which is why it's been incredible that, like, most of our core team this year is going to complete 5 years.
Wow.
So the same people who were there 5 years ago, who built Josh Talks when we took it online in 2017 and 18 and moved to regional languages, are the same people who are now working on UPSC. And everyone works on everything. We don't have, like, it's not that I have now, you know, acquired this skill set, so I'm going to get focused on it and only do this. But whenever there is a new initiative or a new project, everyone moves. So that also, I think, you know, has this spur of excitement where you're not going to be every 1 year you're working on a new problem, on a harder problem. And then that continues to fuel that curiosity.
Absolutely. No, that's phenomenal to note. I think a lot of, again, very fundamental learnings to hire, you know, strong 0-to-1 teams who can also be used for scaling. And as folks who build this company as young as you were, I think this is very encouraging for anybody looking to start from unconventional backgrounds. So lovely. To conclude, I think I have a similar set of questions that I asked. These are very quick questions about your persona. We've covered much of it, but maybe a couple of them to go. If I had to ask you how your friends describe you, what would you tell me?
I think they would call me tenacious. I think that'll be the word. I don't even know how you pronounce it. Is it tenacious or tenacious? Tenacious.
Okay.
But I think other than that, it would be someone who doesn't give up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing. The other aspect of, you know, a founder that I have really appreciated is how founders continue to act, yet at the same time, they're thinking about the long term, they're grasping the current trends, and they are very self-aware. Do you, on a very strategic level, have any principles that help you do this, right? This constant absorption, action, and future thinking, how do you make that happen?
Yeah, I honestly think that that doesn't work for me. I believe in not taking ourselves this seriously. I love to write. So, you know, any kind of decision that I have to take, any kind of information that I need to act on, anything that I've learned, that I've absorbed, I am a sucker for writing. So, and I'm a sucker for reading physical books. So, even in meetings, even in conversations, like, I'm always writing things and then I will translate it and actually type it out. And I think that really helps, because when you are writing, you are actually thinking. And then the way that you write also determines the decision that you take in that moment. So that really helps me stay structured.
Lovely, lovely. Awesome. What is life beyond Josh Talks for you? What do you do beyond immediate work, if I had to call it that?
Yeah, so that's also been an interesting phase to actually realize that there is life beyond work. But I think one of the things that I've started doing now very rigorously is that I exercise a lot. So I've become a workout, like a workaholic. I mean, you can't say workaholic, but a workoutaholic. Yeah. So I love going to the gym. And I think this is also because of like some people in my life. Especially Ankur, like he's been working out a lot and I got inspired from him. And now I've just decided that I have to be fitter than him.
Nice. So, yeah. Awesome. Lovely to know that. The next one is a bit tricky, but I'd love to know your thoughts. Are there any things in the last decade that you strongly believed in, but have changed your mind on? If you had to think about that, this was like a very core belief, but due to work and due to the learnings, you've now thought about them radically differently.
Yeah, I think, an interesting thought here would be how quickly AI has evolved. So I think that was something that, you know, in the initial stages when everyone was talking about artificial intelligence, almost like an alien creature. And I think this is back in 2016-17, when the conversation first started. I didn't think that it would evolve so rapidly that we'll be in a position that we are in today. Yeah. So I think that's something that's actually been really interesting to see, but also something which has made me realize that the pace at which things were moving 5 years back are not the pace at which things are going to move now. Right. And you know, like something like YouTube took 4 years to grow in India. It started in around 2014-15. That's the wave of content creators, the original group that started. And in 2018-19, it started picking up. So we were used to that pattern and that trend, but that's not the case with any other thing now. So that's been interesting to see.
Got it. That's amazing. For the second last bit, I'd love to know, you know, there are so many things that get said about the founder journey, but not enough about why would you not want to pursue it, right? Which is also another way. So I wouldn't say that we have to prove the negative, but what are things about the journey if you got an option to? I know, you know, most founders don't want to change anything about the past, but what are things about the journey you wouldn't want to do again if you got a chance?
Yeah, I think, so one of the things that I've spoken of is, you know, like this whole question of doubt, right? Especially when you have a group of mentors who are probably not the right set for you, or like, you know, people are questioning every single move, or you're building in a space which is extremely unconventional when people don't know about something. Like our early stage of Josh, when YouTube was not big, right, was very, very different. Like YouTube is looked at like a sexy career now. If you're a YouTuber, you've made it. Oh my god, you have 1 million subscribers, it's a game changer. Earlier it was looked at like ki kya kar rahe ho aap,
correct?
You know, ये कौन देखता है, ये कितनी फालतू की चीज़ है, इस पर आप अपनी लाइफ बिताना चाहते हो. सो दैट काइंड ऑफ नॉइज देन मेक्स यू डाउट योर सेल्फ एंड देन यू टेंड टू टेक द रॉन्ग सेट ऑफ डिसीजंस एंड यू मूव स्लोली. सो आई थिंक दैट वुड लाइक दैट एंटायर पीरियड ऑफ प्रॉबेबली लिसनिंग टू अदर्स एंड टेकिंग सर्टेन डिसीजंस बेस्ड ऑन देयर व्यू कुड हैव बीन एक्सपेडाइटेड बाय 3 to 4 years. So I think that's one of the things that I would really change. And the second is that I have had this relationship with books, which has been a love and hate relationship, where I have periods where I just like I'm finishing 2 to 3 books a week. And then I have periods where for 6 months, I'm not able to even pick one up. That's something that I really want to change even now and make it into a routine, because the most amount of progress that I personally feel I have is when I am lost in the stories of others who've actually done something. And for me, getting back to that and making that a routine again and again is a tough battle that I have to kind of fight and change.
Awesome. No, I think that again summarizes very well. There are what things that, you know, you would probably like to change, and maybe I'm sure you're working on them already. What's very interesting for the last question, and I'm trying to phrase this in the best way and not sound very stereotypical, but maybe I'll go as it comes. If you could go back to that 19-year-old who was starting up from college last year, what are things that you would tell yourself? I know you've said it in so many words in different ways, but now that, you know, there are so many youngsters who can look at your journey and be like, it is possible to come from an unconventional background and break it in tech, have a mission orientation and do things that you're not familiar with, but still be the best at it. what would you tell them, or what would you tell yourself if you had to go back? I think I'd love to know that, and that'd be a great end.
I think what I would tell my 19-year-old self is what I would also tell myself today. Because it's a similar set of advice that you have to keep going back to in your journey, right? Which is that this is an extremely long-term journey that we've undertaken, and it's a marathon. It's not a sprint, and running fast is only going to tire you out. So I think that's something that, you know, as a 19-year-old with a lot of energy, you want to chase short-term goals and wins. And you don't realize, but even now, and especially as a founder, when you go through different phases, again, you go back to that, you know, okay, let's grow fast. Let's, you know, achieve the next set of goals.
Yeah.
But I think just taking a step back and kind of understanding why you started, where do you want to go, and slowing yourself down actually helps.
Got it. So long term, marathon, not a sprint, is what we end with. Thank you so much, Supriya, for being on the show. This has been such a pleasure. I think we were able to cover a bunch of things from, storytelling, distribution, and so much about how you've built the business and your learnings. Thank you for being super candid and super honest about your learnings.
Thank you so much. I felt like this was a conversation that I would have without the cameras on as well. But thank you for making it so real.
I'm so glad. Thank you so much.